Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that challenge, shape, and occasionally disrupt our daily lives. As debates over diversity, equity, and inclusion dominate headlines as institutions across the country roll back diversity policy, we're asking a deeper question today. Where did the idea of diversity come from in the first place? My guest is David B. Oppenheimer, a nationally recognized expert in constitutional law and civil rights at UC Berkeley School of Law. His areas of expertise include civil rights, civil liberties, employment and labor law, civil procedure and litigation, human rights, and racial and social justice. Professor Oppenheimer, author of The Diversity Principle, takes us far beyond today's culture wars and into the 200-year history of diversity as a core value of education, science, commerce, and democracy. Once a diversity skeptic himself, Professor Oppenheimer traces how thinkers from John Stuart Mill to Thurgood Marshall to Paul E. Murray understood diversity not as politics, but as a necessary ingredient for truth-seeking, innovation, and freedom. This conversation asks what we lose when diversity is dismissed, and what's at stake for students, institutions, and our democratic culture. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'd like to welcome Professor David B. Oppenheimer to 411 Teen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and thank you for that kind introduction of my book.
Well, I appreciate you taking time to share your expertise with 411 Teen, and I loved your book. It was enlightening. It was really eye-opening, and I recommend it to everyone to read because one tends to think that diversity just came on the scene, maybe in the 1960s, okay? I think that's a general thought, but that's not the case. So I found it very informative. What do you mean? Would you share this with the audience? What do you mean by the diversity principle? And how is it different from how diversity is discussed today?
Thank you. The diversity principle is that when we bring together people with different backgrounds and experiences, people of different ages and religions and races and ethnicities and genders, people with disabilities, people who speak different languages, that they do a better job of solving problems. That in a classroom, they generate more ideas and they learn more. In a science lab, they make more significant discoveries. In business, they make more money. And in government, they come up with more innovative public policies. The effect of bringing together people who are outsiders and mixing them with people who are insiders is that we generate more knowledge and understanding. That's the principle.
Okay.
Now, you had a second part to that question, which is what's happening to that principle today? Was that the question?
Yeah. How does it differ from, you know, what's happening today?
Yeah. So in the past few years, we have seen this dramatic first we saw this dramatic embrace of the diversity principle, where it moved from being an important part of university life to being an important part of commerce with the business case for diversity, and an important part of science as scientists began testing the theory and finding that diversity really did make a difference. And now we've seen this enormous pushback by those who feel threatened by the idea that diversity is a positive value. So we have what in many ways has become a war on diversity, led by our current president, who has declared that diversity is just another word for discrimination against white men. That's not right. That's not what it is. But he's had an enormous effect on companies, on universities, on the funding of science, and it's been a real problem in terms of growing the impact of the diversity principle.
Professor Oppenheimer, you described yourself as a former diversity skeptic.
Yeah.
What changed your thinking?
As is so often true, looking for more information changes what we think about something. Mm-hmm. I started out thinking that diversity was sort of a Band-Aid, an excuse for minor changes in college admissions, a substitute for really addressing problems of discrimination and inequality. And, Justice Thomas, Clarence Thomas, says that diversity is just a preference by white liberals to have a few black faces in the room for aesthetic reasons. Now he's exaggerating knowingly, but I kind of felt the same way. And then I started to look into the history of diversity. And the more I dug, the more I realized that this really is a foundational principle to first to higher education, starting in the early 19th century, and then to the law of free speech and the law of academic freedom, and then ultimately civil rights law, and that the spread of this idea of diversity into the business world and into science was completely justified by the empirical evidence that tells us that diversity is real. It really makes a difference. So that sort of was my path.
So what was the impetus for you to write this book at this time?
Well, to start with, I started working on this in 2012.
Okay.
When many of your listeners had not yet been born or were just infants. And in fact, I have five grandchildren, one of whom is a teenager. And it was soon after I started working on this book that my son and his wife informed my wife and I that we were about to become grandparents. So it's taken a long time for the book to get through its childhood and adolescence. I was challenged. I was challenged by a colleague who said that you're not taking diversity seriously and you're making assumptions and you're better than that. You should be looking at this more deeply. And so I realized she was right. And I put together a team of research assistants at Berkeley to work with me. I've been assisted by, over these 12 years, over 100 Berkeley students. And they've just done remarkable work in helping me dig into this. And we quickly found that the work of John Stuart Mill and his partner and ultimately his wife, Harriet Taylor Mill, in their book on liberty, really dig deeply into the idea of diversity. They actually start the book with a quote about the importance of diversity, and they explore why including women and including people of minority religions, they were of a minority religion, they were Unitarians, and that meant that they couldn't participate in many of the public activities in British life in the early 19th century. Oxford and Cambridge were closed to Unitarians or Catholics or Jews, and they began campaigning to open up the universities. He, as a member of parliament, proposed suffrage for women, the right to vote, and home rule for Ireland, and new rights for black Jamaicans, and the right of Jews to run for parliament, which at that point was not permitted. He lost on all of those things. But in the process, they more deeply appreciated and wrote about the importance of hearing the voices of others, hearing differing opinions from people who hold differing opinions, engaging with people from different countries, different races, different religions, as a way of expanding our own view of the world. So that the notion that middle of the 19th century, John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill were writing about this, it reawoke for me material I'd forgotten and a new appreciation for how this idea of diversity had been generated. And then they had cited, quoted Wilhelm von Humboldt, who was one of these remarkable figures of the German-Prussian Enlightenment and Romantic period, one of the great figures of Western history. He was the inventor of the modern field of linguistics. He was a minority in that he was a Huguenot in Prussia and participated as a teenager in these Jewish intellectual salons.
Allow me to interrupt you and ask you just to hold your thoughts. This is one of the times. Hold your thoughts for a few seconds. We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I'm having a fantastic time with Professor David B. Oppenheimer. He is the author of The Diversity Principle. Professor Oppenheimer, I had to interrupt you, but you want to continue your thoughts and your history. I mean, this is just such a great history lesson, because what you're saying and what I'm hearing, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is all that you were talking about was revolutionary way back in the early 1800s or 1900s, 1810, I guess, around. Yeah.
1810 was the founding of the University of Berlin by Wilhelm von Humboldt on a foundation of diversity. And this university would normally have been closed to everyone but Protestants. And Humboldt said, we're going to include Catholics and we're going to include Jews, because by broadening the diversity of the people in the university, we will make greater discoveries. We will learn more from each other.
And that was revolutionary then. That was
absolutely revolutionary.
Definitely against the current.
Yeah. Now Humboldt, who led a fascinating life, near the end of his life, was driven from public office and essentially went into an exile in his home in Prussia, because he stood up to anti-Semitism. in a period of rising anti-Semitism in Prussia, in Germany, to the point where his friends and his government abandoned him and chased him out of public life. And he would not relent in his views that anti-Semitism was a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Why was exposure to competing viewpoints seen as necessary and not just an option? It wasn't optional. He wasn't saying this is an option. This is what must be done.
Because if you care about generating the best ideas, if you care about growing our knowledge, if you care about learning and teaching, then you have to include as many voices as you can. You have to reach out to outsiders and bring them mm-hmm. inside the conversation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you end up with a society in which people are falling behind, in which your society is falling behind because you're no longer generating the best ideas. You're no longer doing the best work. And the result of that is, well, we see that in history. Empires mm-hmm. rise and empires fall. And the reason empires fall is in part that they become insular. That's mm-hmm. that's what we are at risk of in the United States today. And that's why it's so important, I think, that mm-hmm. we understand the history of the diversity principle and how important that principle is to our continuing growth of our knowledge, growth of our economy, growth of our democracy.
So how did this history challenge the idea that diversity undermines academic rigor?
Oh, it comes out of people who don't believe that women are as intelligent as men and should be treated as equals, that Black Americans and Hispanic Americans and other people of color are just as smart and talented and hardworking and creative as white people. It comes out of these base views about white male supremacy that mm-hmm. we've always had, but that seem to have been activated in the past few years so that they've become even more important, even more prevalent, even more powerful. Mm-hmm.
John Stuart Mill, his On Liberty, I think, well, I know, influenced the modern ideas of free expression. Would you agree with me on that?
Absolutely. You know, the turning point in American law on the meaning of free speech under the First Amendment was a dissenting opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, in which he argued that we need to protect dissenting views, we need mm-hmm. to protect views we disagree mm-hmm. with, because of the importance of being exposed to lots and lots of ideas. He reached that view because he reread On Liberty, and he had a series of discussions with two young Harvard professors. He was at that point an old man and a Boston Brahmin Protestant. These were two young Jewish professors, one of them Felix Frankfurter, who went on to serve with great distinction on our Supreme Court. The other, Lasky, Harold Lasky, who was British and ultimately had to leave the U.S. because of his views, but became a very important, influential figure in the Labour Party in Britain and at the London School of Economics. And the two of them convinced him to reread and rethink about the meaning of liberty. And that resulted in his writing this dissenting opinion that has mm-hmm. now become the majority view, our understanding that the First Amendment protects a marketplace of ideas.
Mm-hmm. So Mill was arguing that disagreement, difference, even if it is offensive disagreement, it's essential. It's essential to progress, to growth, to understanding. Do I get it right?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. Though I would think that Mill would have said that we have to learn to engage with each other mm-hmm. with respect.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Even when we disagree.
Yeah.
He had this great quote about he views people with whom he disagrees as people who are seeking the same mountaintop, but they're taking a different path mm-hmm. up the mountain.
Yeah.
And I think, I know for me that I learn a lot from talking with people I disagree with. I want to engage with people I disagree with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, will you talk about how Charles Eliot's transformation of Harvard institutionalized the clash of ideas?
Yeah, well, you've put it beautifully that Eliot, who was the president of Harvard for 40 years, from 1869 yep. to 1909, believed, following the German model, that students and professors should engage with each other and should challenge each other's ideas, and that the way we learn is through the clash of ideas. And that was part of why he insisted on admitting Catholics and Jews and mm-hmm. Black Americans and immigrants and poor people to Harvard at a time when it could have been a completely white upper class institution. And he said, that's not what we want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was very controversial at the time.
Yeah. Well, what happens? What happens when academic freedom, what happens to it when diversity is restricted?
Yeah, you know, there are colleges and universities in the United States today where either because of state law or because of the rules imposed by university administrators, professors are told there are certain things you can't say.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you know them to be true, even if you think it's important that your students hear these ideas, you can't talk about, you can't talk about the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about women's rights. You can't express the view that diversity is a positive force in education and in commerce and in science, because there's an official point of view and that's not the official point of view. We're going to take your books out of the library. This is a terrible thing that we're doing to our students.
Yeah. Thurgood Marshall and I guess we'd say Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Pauli Murray, they played a role in expanding the equality framework. Will you address that a little bit? I mean, like Thurgood Marshall understood diversity's role in democracy. And then Ruth Bader and Pauli Murray, you know, we're into expanding equality. I mean, just talk, because I just found your book fascinating, informative and fascinating. You probably could tell I loved it. So would you talk just,
you.
We're going to be out of time, I know, but if, just a little bit about that. Okay.
I'll stay as long as you want.
Well, I only got an hour.
So Thurgood Marshall's initial approach to the problem of Jim Crow and racial segregation was to say this legal doctrine of separate but equal. We're going to chip away at it by showing that the institutions of government, such as universities and schools, are not equal. Mm-hmm. That when you have a public university and then you have a publicly funded black college, they don't get the same resources. And that means that the black students are not getting the equal access they're entitled to. That was his theory. And then along came this remarkable woman, Pauli Murray. Mm-hmm. And she said, there's something else happening here that we need to address. And that is that black students are not getting the opportunity to engage with white students. And that means that they're not getting the benefits of diversity in their education. And, she said, it's having a psychological effect of making them feel inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall took up this idea and made it part of the arguments that ultimately led to Brown v. Board of Education. So in many ways, and ways that he acknowledged, but history hasn't, she helped him reframe the argument about segregation to include an argument about the importance of diversity. The same thing happened a generation later. At that point, Pauli Murray was a staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, and the ACLU had decided to hire a women's rights specialist toward ultimately creating a women's rights practice group at the ACLU. And they interviewed a number of people, and one of them was this very shy, soft-spoken professor from Rutgers University. And the men at the ACLU said, nah, she's kind of shy and soft-spoken. She's not going to be an effective advocate. And Pauli Murray said, you're missing her brilliance. And convinced them to hire her. Her name was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she and Pauli Murray together developed the legal arguments that led to the Supreme Court holding that the right to equality extended to women, so that sex discrimination was a violation of our Constitution. So here again, Pauli Murray plays this extraordinarily important role by making arguments that essentially go to the value of diversity.
Wow. There's so many questions I want to ask you, and I don't have enough time. So I'm looking at the clock thinking, okay, let me cut this out. What lessons from civil rights history are being ignored today with today's backlash? You know, what's happening? What are the lessons from the civil rights? Because that's what we're talking about, that are being ignored.
If we expand the pie, there's more for everyone. If we encourage women and we encourage people of color, and in particular, if we encourage Black Americans to reach their opportunities for excellence, instead of discriminating, we will be a more creative, more productive society. And when I look at what I listened to, the president of the United States talking about, quote, black jobs, by which he means menial labor. That's a disgusting thing to say. And then the way he puts that into effect is that people like Carla Hayden get fired simply because she is a black woman. And the excuses that were used, I probably need to back up. Do you and your readers know who Carla Hayden is? Let me assume that some of your readers don't know her or of her. She was she was the first woman and the first black American to be appointed as the Librarian of Congress for a 10-year term. She had grown up poor in Chicago. As a child, she started, or as a young woman, she started volunteering at the library, reading to children with autism. Over time, she worked her way through college and through graduate school and ultimately earned a PhD in library science from the University of Chicago, one of the great learning institutions of the world. She worked her way up through library systems, was ultimately the chief librarian for the Chicago Public Library System and then the Baltimore Public Library System. And she was appointed 9 years ago now to a 10-year term as Librarian of Congress shortly after President Trump took office for his second term. He fired her. And the explanation given was that she was putting inappropriate books about LGBT people in the children's section of the library.
Hold your thoughts. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and let me reintroduce my special guest that I'm really, really honored to have, and that's Professor David Oppenheimer. He is tracing the 200-year history of diversity as a driver of excellence, freedom, and truth. Professor Oppenheimer, continue your thoughts, please.
Thank you. So Carla Hayden, an incredibly well-qualified librarian with many, many years of experience running library systems. She'd been the elected president of the American Association of Librarians. She's appointed to the head of the Library of Congress. And when President Trump takes office in his second term, he fires her. And the explanation given is that she was putting inappropriate books about LGBT life in the children's section of the library. There is no children's section of the Library of Congress. It's not a lending library. It's a research library for members of Congress and other Americans who are adults to go in and get assistance doing research. It's not a lending library. The excuse that was given was just a bald-faced lie. And you know, if you look in the aggregate at the number of black women who've been fired by the Trump administration, and he's at it again, he's now trying to get Susan Rice thrown off the board of Netflix, saying of Susan Rice that she's just a political hack. This is somebody who earned her PhD at Oxford, where it won a special prize for its excellence. This is somebody, of course, served the United States as our ambassador to the United Nations and as our national security director. And he wants her fired from the board of Netflix because she says she's not qualified. She's just a hack. This is what he does. And there's case after case of black women in particular being fired from jobs that they had earned by demonstrating their excellence. this is an attempt to nullify all of the benefits of diversity, and that's not good for our country.
What do you see as the real motivations behind today's attacks on diversity? I mean, are the diversity programs being criticized for what they do or what people think they represent?
Yeah, well, the claim that's made is that programs that promote diversity are a form of discrimination against white men. And look, I'm sure there are DEI training programs out there that are not very good. I'm sure that there is a phenomenon in this world of discrimination against white men. In the 1970s, Thurgood Marshall, as a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, wrote a unanimous opinion in the Santa Fe case saying that discrimination against white men is a violation of federal law. But big picture, it's rare. Big picture, white men have enormous advantages in employment and in other parts of American life. Big picture, white men earn much more for the same work as women, as black men, and particular as black and Hispanic women. So this is a made up excuse that I think is being made for political reasons and is very, very damaging.
Yeah, it is. What is lost? What's lost when institutions abandon diversity as a value?
Yeah, well, the individual terrible losses to people who are suddenly outsiders again, and institutional losses to those organizations because they no longer get the benefit of the diversity effect. If they're businesses, they're going to be less successful in business. If they're universities, they're going to generate fewer ideas. If they're science labs, they're going to generate fewer discoveries. This is what costs all of us if we lose the value of the diversity effect.
Is the backlash against diversity actually just a backlash against pluralism?
Yeah, well, certainly there's a very close relationship and diversity, or the diversity principle. And it's, I think it's fair. I think that's a fair analysis to say that this is it's a backlash against pluralism. It's a backlash against equal opportunity. It's a backlash against including people who have been perennial outsiders and allowing them to take their rightful place as insiders, because there's room for us to all be inside.
Yeah. But they don't want us all inside, you know?
Apparently not.
They feel like we're going to overcome. We're going to, oh, what was that? What did they say in Virginia? They're going to be replaced.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, they said, specifically, I think they said first, you will not replace us. And then they said, Jews will not replace us.
Right.
Do you know how many Jews there are in the United States? The number is tiny. I think we're about 6 million out of a population of 350 million. The notion that we could replace anyone is laughable. There aren't enough of us. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of this general sort of replacement theory that liberals or liberal Jews or liberal Jews and blacks are trying to eliminate white people from America so that America can be run by people of color. It's this fantasy. Now it is true that the white population of the United States is shrinking, and that means that it's easier and easier for the United States to gain the benefits of diversity, but it doesn't mean taking anything away from anyone.
Mm-hmm. But you know, if public universities continue dismantling diversity initiatives, what do you predict that education will look like in 10 years for our grandchildren?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's in about 10 years that my grandchildren will be going to college.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that this isn't going to last. I think that most people in this country are pretty smart about what's happening. And it's a matter of common sense. And people were scared. And people went along with views that they didn't necessarily agree with. But I refuse to believe that we will continue down this path of denying science and denying the voices of outsiders and denying the value of diversity. It's so suicidal. It's so self-destructive.
Well, it's a risk. It seems like there's a risk of intellectual stagnation.
Well, yeah, that's true. And it's certainly true that empires come and empires go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're right. There's enormous risk. And my optimism when I say that I can't believe that we're going to continue with this is not so much based on evidence. I think it's based on personality. Huh. And there's lots of evidence in world history that nations and people make wrong turns and make foolish errors that mm-hmm. doom them.
Yeah. Well, you began as a skeptic. If you were speaking to someone today who is skeptical, what would you say?
I'd say, take a walk with me through our great cities, through our great universities, through our great shared history, and look at the way that we have built this enormously successful economy, this enormously successful scientific community, this enormously successful set of universities. We're the envy of the world because of our success. And look at how much we have grown since the 1960s, when we passed the civil rights laws. That's the power of diversity. Look at how much we have grown in the 45 years between 1978, when the Supreme Court said diversity justifies affirmative action, and 2023, when the Supreme Court said, well, no, It doesn't. An affirmative action is illegal. In those 45 years, look at the success of this country and look at the ideas we've generated and look at the way in which the voices of women and the voices of people of color, and the voices of people with disabilities, the voices of people who are outsiders, who, when we crack the door open a little bit, were able to make their way inside and make us so much more successful. Do you want to give that up? Do you want to not believe that any of that matters? I think that's what I'd say.
How can, gosh, we're out of time. You believe we have four more minutes? I can't believe this. It's impossible. If diversity is an essential ingredient for a robust intellectual and political culture, what must we do right now to protect the next generation?
We have to start talking with people with whom we disagree about the things that we think are important and why. We need to listen to them, and we need to ask them to listen to us. Because that, among other things, will bring us the diversity effect. We're not, none of us are always right. I've certainly made plenty of mistakes in my life. We learn from our mistakes. I mean, that's why I know so much. But each of us has to examine carefully the tools that our democracy has used to build such a successful society and ask ourselves, how can we commit to making good use of those tools? And how can we take up the question with our friends and family and neighbors with whom we disagree about how to build a forward path that includes everyone?
Well, how can we defend diversity without turning it into a partisan issue?
For so long it wasn't. I mean,
I know.
The three Supreme Court judges who wrote the three opinions on the importance of diversity in the late 20th century and early 21st century were each conservative Republicans. It's John Stuart Mill is a hero to libertarians. The biographer, first biographer of Harriet Taylor Mill, who helped get many of these ideas out there, was F.Y. Hayek, a hero to right-wing conservative intellectuals. These ideas are not simply, they don't simply belong to one faction. They're universal. Mm-hmm. And we have to find ways that we can all embrace them.
Well, we are out of time. And I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your knowledge with us. I mean, I enjoyed your book. It was eye-opening for me. So I can't express how much I appreciate you taking the time. But it is time out for 411 Team. My guest has been Professor David B. Oppenheimer, UC Berkeley Professor of Law and author of The Diversity Principle. In a moment when diversity is under attack, the book reminds us that the real risk isn't difference, it's uniformity. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.